This is Strategy Taken, a podcast about hard decisions and how strategic leaders in financial services make them, with your host, Luis Sorzella.
Welcome to the Strategy Taken. Today, I'm very excited because we have my friend Paul Sims in the show with us. Paul is a kindred spirit because he also has that same experience in frontline, being advisor to executives and in the startup, which I think is a tremendous combination that gives a fantastic background to and down-to-earth type of practicality to professionals. Paul is today an advisor to executive teams and investors, privately held companies, but he is also a serial entrepreneur, board member, advisor, especially in the insurance space. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Good to be with you.
We're glad to have you here. Paul, I gave the very short version of you, but like maybe you would like to introduce yourself.
Sure. I think you did a great job. It's always more comfortable for someone else to introduce you than yourself. But I spent the better part of 20 years building and scaling technology companies, and mostly B2B. And then more recently have expanded into a lot more work in later stage, more mature businesses, mostly in financial services insurance area. And so it's been a fun journey, and it's interesting to see how the two fit together and the real need for some of the things we dealt with 10, 15 years ago, 20 years ago in other businesses is now starting to become very relevant in that insurance and financial services space. And there's a lot of disruption happening. So it's very interesting.
I know that you are particularly enthusiastic about the conjunction of technology, insurance, especially on the distribution side, right?
Yes, yes. I've been focused, even before I got into insurance, was always focused on distribution. So I worked with several of my businesses, worked with car dealers, which don't manufacture cars, but they very much distribute them, and worked with them, you know, all over the world. And I think there's a lot of fascinating things you can learn about the ecosystem of distribution of expensive, quickly depreciating assets. As you think about, you know, assets that aren't like that, you know, namely insurance policies, and thinking about, well, how do you reach the customer cost effectively? How do you reach the right customer, which I think is something the insurance industry is not traditionally focused a lot on, is segmentation. And how do you capture some of that entrepreneurial spirit that makes car dealerships, for example, so profitable and so successful, and make sure that you're delivering that in your distribution model? I think agencies are good at a lot of that, but some of the technology capabilities are some new areas where they're going to be expanding and growing and learning.
I know that the technology in the distribution side has advanced a decade in the past 2 years, right? Because of COVID, because of the remote work.
Yes, yes. It's been amazing that when COVID first hit, I remember talking to someone, it was probably 30 days into everybody being locked at home. And they said, boy, this is really going to change how we work. And I said, no, this will be gone in 60 days. It's like the bird flu a few years ago. It won't, America's not going to. And I had to eat a lot of crow because it certainly has. You know, I do think that the pendulum is starting to swing back. I'm seeing more and more companies saying, hey, we really would like you in the office, you know, the majority of the time. But the change in mentality and flexibility, not just at the company level, where you see a wide range of companies that never would have dreamed of it 3 years ago, allowing people 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 days a week at home, to the personal level, where I have friends that'll reach out that, you know, 3 years ago, they would have said, let's meet at Starbucks or a coffee shop and catch up. And now they'll say, what time do you want me to send the Zoom invite for? And so I think it's becoming more of a personal habit that, yes, you want to be in person, but maybe 30 to 50% of what you would go out of your way to make in person, you could actually do remotely very efficiently. You and I are having this conversation in two different locations. And 5, 10 years ago, that might have been awkward or felt like it wasn't going to work. So I think it's fascinating.
Yes. And I think that has been an acceleration in the adoption of all these things and on the technology and on the market, but we only seen the start of it, I think. Yeah. Paul, I understand that actually this is related to the story that you have to tell us today. It's about your time with Assurant, right?
Yes, yes. In fact, it predates Assurant, but it rolled into Assurant. So I hope I can live up to the stories that you've had with other more esteemed guests in the past. But you know, as we were talking about the challenge we grappled in the business, I think it struck both of us that it could be applicable and of interest to your audience. So if we back up maybe to 2016, there was a company based in Chicago called The Warranty Group, and they were the largest auto warranty company in the world. And they were actually a very old company. They spun out of Aon many years before that. And they sell these extended warranties, or as they're called, vehicle service contracts, to dealerships. And the dealership then sells that to the consumer when they purchase their vehicle. And these will cover any type of mechanical breakdowns on the vehicle and those types of issues, and help consumers have a consistent expense each month for their vehicle, as opposed to, you know, a $500, $600 expense that was not expected. For most consumers would have to actually go borrow that money. So that's kind of the purpose of the product. And the company was owned by a private equity firm. It had changed hands a couple of times since it came from Aon. And the TPG Capital was the owner. And they reached out and asked me to come in with a new CEO and grow the company so that it could be sold. And what they asked for help with was to build out a digital channel for selling these products. They were well known among car dealers, but if you looked at some of the newer players that were selling cars online, they had absolutely no name recognition, no market share at all. So think of Carvana in, you know, late 2016. Mm-hmm. Most people didn't know Carvana outside of the handful of markets they operated in, like Atlanta. Think about Shift. They were not on the radar of anyone. They're now, you know, publicly traded. CarGurus, an online marketplace. So those types of players that in any way were transacting cars online or helping online transact cars, they felt very exposed and felt like that was a key linchpin for the company's future. And I pointed out to them, I knew very little about their space, but I knew digital and I knew automotive from my past businesses, and jumped into this, you know, 50-year-old company to bring a little bit of the startup mentality and help them build out this business. And what was interesting were a few things. First of all, they were set up, structured, and optimized both culturally and operationally to serve car dealers. And car dealers, you know, make their decisions and run their business a certain way. And when they sell the warranty, they hope, and in most cases, they get their hopes realized, that you will bring the car back to them when the repair is needed. You technically could bring it anywhere, but they're planning on you bringing it back to them because the selling dealer who sold you that contract and that car has a repair facility on site, and they make fantastic margins off of that. And as we sat down and I started meeting with the players like Carvana, for example, and helping them think through how to build out their warranty business, it became clear we needed a new model. So they don't have repair facilities. They have no intention anytime soon of building repair facilities. And when you say to the consumer, we'll repair your car, their natural reaction would be, well, I'll bring it back to you, right? Just like if you and I bought a laptop at Best Buy, the natural inclination of people is to go back to where you bought it, say it's broken, can you solve it? Carvana couldn't do that. Shift didn't want to do that. They had a facility to do repairs, but didn't want to be in the repair business. And so you had this core operating tenet of here's how it works that we had to sort of cast aside and start fresh. So that was one interesting challenge we had to deal with. And as I talked to some of the folks who were more experienced in the space and had done it for 30 years and said, well, you know, where can we get repairs done? They said, well, aren't they going to do the repairs? No, they don't want to and aren't even capable of it.
Yes.
So we had this challenge. We had to figure out how we would actually deliver on the promise of the product we were going to try to sell.
And as I said, the warranty group had been built and was both, in your words, culturally and operationally designed to service within this business model.
Yes, exactly. So what we did, you probably don't want too many of the details, but we basically had to look around and say, what are some ways that we could deliver on that promise of a repair? But we had to thread the needle of Carvana doesn't actually want them to go to a dealer from whom they might buy their next car. They want a repair done. They want to keep the customer happy, but not really at a dealership. So we had to identify a partner with a independent repair shop that doesn't sell cars network. And then we also had to look at, because one of the key opportunities we saw was to bring maintenance services, so oil changes in. And so when you received your car and it had the coverage, you would have free oil changes for a time period. And we needed facilities to do that. Well, most repair facilities don't want to do oil changes. They're low margin. They would rather change your transmission, $5,000 versus $50. And so we had to build a partner network that wanted to do oil changes and then deliver a way for a consumer to actually know, because you don't want them to call on the phone and say, where can I go? Well, where are you located? Well, let me look it up for you. You want to make it easy for them. That needed to match Carvana's brand. So that was the challenge we had to work through. We were able to develop a very simple app that would direct them to the partners that could do the repair at an agreed upon price with the right service level, and it would meet Carvana's needs. And we were able to build out that capability. But it was certainly, for an organization that was so mature and so good at what they did, it was a little bit like the CEO of IBM that talked about getting an elephant to do ballet, I believe is the quote, a little bit of a challenge. And I recall the head of service who managed the team that would take all these phone calls when you call in to get a repair, approved. He looked at me and he was 2 years away from retirement. And he said, Paul, we're an insurance company, not a technology company. You just need to recognize that. And he was right. That's what they were, but they needed to change. And the board understood that we needed to bring, not throw everything out, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, but bring in some new capabilities. And so I was amazed at when you helped the different teams that would be involved understand the vision of where you were going to go, and that it wasn't discarding, but it was building on what they had. They rallied behind it, and we actually delivered our piece of the technology solution ahead of our partners in every single time where we took a new program live. So I was amazed. You wouldn't expect that from an insurance company, but we did it.
Oh, yes. Oh, I want to double click on this, but like before this, two things that you didn't mention when you were talking about this, the whole situation that I was expecting. One is that I assume that this product also had completely different economics than the economics of your traditional products, right? Because again, on your traditional products, even if the marginal customer is barely profitable, you make money out of him on other stuff. But on this new one, you need to have a product that is profitable on its own, or at least it attracts new customers. Yes. So like the economics are different. And the other thing that I didn't hear, which I was expecting, is that I assumed that you would get a lot of pushback from your existing customers from launching this product, because again, you're making their new entrants more competitive and stealing stuff from them.
Well, you know, let's hit those one at a time. Let's take your economics one first. So we had multiple customers. Carvana was the example that I gave, but we worked with CarGurus, which is a classifieds online car marketplace, Shift, which is a competitor to Carvana, a smaller competitor. And we worked with a company that was sold, but at the time was called Canvas, which was a used car subscription business. So you'd pay a monthly fee. They would pay for any repairs, maintenance, everything but gas. And I would say that the economics on the Carvana type product were not dramatically different. You know, we were able to work things out in terms of the needs of the different players and the pricing so that that didn't look all that different. But the Canvas business actually did look quite different. And we were basically helping manage a fleet of vehicles because they owned the car, but they weren't the one driving it. Mm-hmm. And they said, we don't mind paying for the repair that needs to happen or the maintenance, but so we don't necessarily need you to take risk off the table for us, but we do need help with knowing where to send the consumer. So we need to manage a network, and we have no idea what the right cost should be. So we need you to keep the repair facility honest, right? Which is a key role that people often ignore when they think about what a warranty company does. Is if they don't own the repair facility, they're sort of making sure that costs are kept the right way, so you don't have to raise prices. So that actually had quite different economics and a different set of capabilities that we had to use as a company. But I think if you think about insurance businesses, they have a skill set of sizing up risk and figuring out how to price for that risk and how to allocate it. And so the skill set was there. It just was a muscle that hadn't been moved in that direction, right? I've done curls, but I haven't done bench press. Well, muscles, I can teach you bench press, right? So we learned.
I'm going to use this metaphor in the future, by the way. I loved it.
Okay. So I was there with underwrite. I had never done underwriting in my life, but the underwriters, when I helped them understand what the client was trying to achieve, were able to think through how we could price it to cover our costs and make a reasonable profit and still deliver what the client needed, which was different from what all of other clients needed. And so, you know, one of my things was I went into this thinking, this is a 50-year-old company. They have a way of doing things, and I'm going to face constant pushback. Mm-hmm. And I would get initial pushback, but I have to say, one of the things I loved about the company was a willingness to explore it. If let me vent up front, and then I'll explore this problem with you and help you solve it. And that was refreshing, and it made all the difference. We went from a nobody in digital to the number one player in about 24 to 30 months. So we landed, you know, Carvana, the largest player by far, Shift, Canvas, CarGurus. We built from nothing. Both capabilities and revenue streams, and got on the map of several others that while I was there, we, you know, just didn't get programs set up with, but we were on their consideration set, whereas before we weren't. So I think large organizations can, and insurance companies can, adapt to these things if there's a willingness at the top and the right attitude. And it definitely was a company, while it was old and large, had an entrepreneurial spirit. Really in the culture, which was key. So I might have dug into economics too much, but without enough numbers, but I think that culture permeated the whole problem. The second question you asked was, did our current customer base, our legacy customer base, and we had the largest players in the world. So Lithia, publicly traded, Penske, CarMax. So large players, AutoNation, that were clients. And we didn't sort of advertise that we were serving them. We served all of their traditional competitors already, right? So by serving AutoNation, serving Penske, those two compete with each other in some markets. So there's sort of an understanding that in a B2B world, you know, if there's many players, you're going to naturally serve some competitors. And C, and I think this was probably a key one, was I was not a part of the traditional team that called on, you know, the AutoNation of the world or the Joe car dealer in any given city. So I really had a different business unit, if you will. And so it didn't come up too often, but occasionally the folks that worked with those dealers would give me a little bit of ribbing for helping these digital players. But they were already going to get service from one of our competitors And so it might as well be us that that served them was the point of view that I had.
So you delivered that ahead of schedule, and it was tremendously successful. Now, you want to talk about this?
Well, I mean, all I had to do was find the right people and find the vision. They we had some technology resources that did a great job. Our claims team was very effective at adjusting to really a different way of handling things in some ways. And they were quite a few different teams involved in delivering it. And there was a willingness, and this was also surprising to me, to allow outside technology resources, which you often find pushback there. We had an internal technology team that was heads down building a new CRM from the beginning to end. But instead of saying, well, let's put you in line behind the CRM, which is a multi-year process, they said, you know, it feels like some of the capabilities you need are something that could be built by someone from the outside and connect in. Well, let's go that route. And so I think that willingness to say it doesn't have to be built here, as long as there's communication and interaction, was what allowed us to deliver the parts that were internally built were delivered on time. The parts that were externally built delivered on time. And to see an insurance company wait for partners to be finished is kind of a ironic twist. But I can't get credit for anything other than trying to help sort of bring the right musicians in the room.
But still, that's a huge feat, because you're describing something that most companies put as top of their agendas, programs like this, but fail. So what did you do right that everybody else does wrong?
I think what I said a minute ago about getting outside resources when it's the logical decision is a really key one. I've had a few instances with some other large companies in the past where I was in the innovation and new business area. And when there's not a willingness to recognize that skill sets could be different, even if the function title is the same, like technology, right? Java is different from Ruby on Rails. Yeah. And so recognizing, because we have that function doesn't mean we have the skill sets. And recognizing that new ventures, innovation, whatever name you want to put on it, might need to move both at a different speed and also have a different set of incentives in place for the talent were, I think, key measures anytime it's been successful, both this time and others. And I think those are ones that I see companies trip on, is this assumption that talent is fungible and compensation and incentives all need to be exactly the same doing different things. An example that an analogy that a friend gave me many years ago that I've always loved is, we had this 50-year-old company at the time and a startup. And the idea that some folks had was, let's put them together. And we said, would you really put a toddler with someone who's in a retirement home and expect that to work out? They have different needs, right? And so the same thing was here. We had different needs in the business, and you need to recognize that. When companies don't, I think that's when they stumble, is trying to treat the two the same, hold them to the same bar. The startup is not going to deliver the same economic results, both bottom line or top line. And you're going to need new approaches, might need new culture. And in some cases, what that means is you need to set it outside the company and have the company have an ownership. Other times you can have it, like we did in this case with the warranty group, and later we were acquired by Assurant, have it in the company, but give it enough leeway that if the internal operations are not set up to serve, no one's toes get stepped on, and you can serve those in a different way.
Yeah, fantastic. Paul, thank you. That's very interesting. Let me ask you one thing, for if anyone is listening and would like to get in touch with you and would like to connect, what should they do?
Oh, well, if anyone would want to talk to me, probably an email is easiest. I'm a big fan, as you know, from when we met, of actually meeting people as opposed to just connecting to them on LinkedIn. So send me an email at thepaulsims@outlook.com, thepaulsims@outlook.com.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Lise. thepaulsims@outlook.com.
Thank you for listening. If you are open to knowing more, you can subscribe to our podcast and find us on thestrategytaken.com.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Lise.